May it please the court, although this case has come to you as a fairly simple failure to properly file a case, it also involves really some very severely problematic and erroneous decision, both the attorney fees case that comes to you now and the underlying case. Granted, at the most basic level, Mr. Funk failed to file either on time, not filing within 30 days after the Administrative Hearing Commission decision, or he filed in the wrong court. But also, he fails to earn attorney fees or other expenses because the underlying case was decided in his favor on the most slimmest of evidence. And he used the wrong standard, the Administrative Hearing Commission uses the wrong standard when determining substantial justification at its level, trying to decide whether it's on appeal, whether it was the position by the Real Estate Appraisers Commission on appeal or the position of the commission at the underlying case. The AHC also special factors analysis is contrary to the law, not supported by evidence, and was arbitrary and capricious. On all points, the decision really attempts to go at the edges of the law and even beyond it to get to the result that it was seeking to obtain. Now, on the first issue, Section 536.087.3 requires the filing in standard cases to be in the court where a party first prevailed within 30 days of that decision. In this case, that would have required Mr. Funk to have filed within 30 days after the Administrative Hearing Commission. As granted to be an unusual circumstance, he did not at that point in the case.
But he didn't prevail in the Administrative Hearing Commission.
He did prevail at the Administrative Hearing Commission. He prevailed, but he prevailed without an attorney. He had no attorney's fees at that point. He may have had other expenses, so he could have still filed the case based on other expenses that he may have incurred during that proceeding, and still would have been entitled to bring that action. That would have then been held in abeyance throughout all the subsequent litigation until the ruling would have been made after the Court of Appeals ruled in his favor again. The Circuit Court ruled against him, but then he prevailed again at the Court of Appeals level. So their argument is that it should have been allowed to file after the Court of Appeals decision because he prevailed in that court, a prevailing party in that court. Now, that would go contrary to the decisions that have previously been developed as not being the first prevailing court. But even if we were to allow him to file in that court, Section 536.087.4 gives two options of where to file. If you prevailed in an agency proceeding, then you file at the agency within 30 days. But if you want to argue that you prevailed at the Court of Appeals, then you file within 30 days after that Court of Appeals argument action. He did not do either of those. So the statute gave him two options. He did neither of them correctly. That was the basis of the ruling at the Court of Appeals, and they stopped there.
Where in the statute is authority for having to file where you first prevail?
The statute really doesn't say that other than it being the sequence of events. It talks about filing in the agency first and then filing if you need to later in the Court of Appeals. That really comes up in the cases of Sherway and Red Dragon, and then really supported by this court in Greenbrier, which Greenbrier does not specifically make that comment either, other than it goes through a significant of analysis to establish that they were the court in which he first prevailed.
And the question is, are those cases correct if there is no, if they are not based on authority in the statute for that requirement? But I mean, the statute guides, so how do we reach the result that they reached by properly applying the statute?
I think the decisions are correct, but if this, I think part of our argument in this case is that even if this court wants to set aside the first prevail requirement, we would disagree with the notion that some party can simply file after prevailing in any court. So say they file at the Administrative Hearing Commission, they win. They file attorney's fees, or they don't file attorney's fees.
I understand that part
they
of your
go to the
argument.
Circuit court,
I just want to address
they
the
win,
first part.
Then we don't want, so we don't want to create a rule that allows them to just pick any court along the way in which they win, assuming they win at every level.
So is there another statute that also governs? Because the 087.3 says, shall within 30 days of a final disposition in an agency proceeding or final judgment in a civil action. So it doesn't address first prevail, but it says final disposition in an agency proceeding, does that refer to when the agency completes its first ruling on the substance or after remand from if you've appealed to the circuit court?
No, it's real clear and I think very established and very correct that when you're referring to filing within 30 days after the agency decision, that decision is final, that is done, it needs to be done within 30 days of that date. They can't then later, as I think Funk does argue, just say that, well, we also prevailed after the Court of Appeals, so we can go back.
Well, what if the Court of Appeals sends it back to the agency? Why couldn't they then do it, and the agency then reaches a decision?
If they remanded to the agency, the agency issued out a new decision, I think they could. That's not what occurred in this case. In this case, they simply prevailed at the Court of Appeals. Nothing further was required back at the agency level. And then 536.087.4 requires at that step that, as it says, a prevailing party in a civil action on appeal from an agency proceeding shall submit an application for fees and expenses to the court. But they will not submit that at that stage back to the agency level. So there's no authority in the statute for the Court of Appeals to simply remand the filing of the initial application back to the underlying agency. If they prevail at the Court of Appeals, that is where they are to file. It's also interesting in this case, since he had no attorney at the underlying actions level, it seems since he did prevail at the Court of Appeals that at that point it probably would have even been appropriate for the Court of Appeals to review.
Even though under the case law he had prevailed originally in the agency.
Well, I mean, if you're going to go that way, I think the standard rule is when somebody wins, you want them filing for attorney's fees. People know that's out there. They know that is there. This brings up the unusual circumstances of him not having any attorneys at that level. That he still, as we said, could have still filed for other expenses. It didn't prevent him, I don't even think, from filing for attorney's fees on the anticipation that he might have them later if it appealed.
But there's no case that says you have to do that.
That you have to do what?
File for attorney's fees when you don't have an attorney.
No, the situation is not contemplated by the statute specifically on these on these things. Moving to the next matters, the substantial justification. This case involves basically a case in which, in the underlying decision, the Real Estate Appraisers Commission denied an application for a general certification. That's certification to allow him to do commercial appraisals. They reviewed two commercial appraisals and found significant problems in those appraisals. They called him in for an interview, asked him about the problems that they found in the appraisals. They essentially found he admitted to those problems because he basically said that, no, he did not base, and the most significant error was something to do with the capitalization rate. Capitalization rate is a percentage that is applied to an anticipated stream of income to then get you to a value. And he did not have any good way to explain how he came to that value until he admitted that he had purposely omitted the capitalization rate he pulled from an adjoining piece of the property, and that is what he had based his capitalization rate on.
But didn't the AHC found that it would rely on the later two appraisals?
It did. It then went through, and at the sole testimony, he then put in three other appraisals into evidence. Those three other appraisals, though, were virtually identical to the ones before, but he had not provided the work files and things that were necessary for proper reviews. They had not been reviewed by the expert. There was no testimony by our side or by him really regarding the competency of those appraisals or what was different about those appraisals. Until the commissioner asked, well, did you prepare these appraisals in violation of USPAP? Did you prepare these appraisals in compliance with USPAP? He answers yes. Well, maybe not totally so, but it's a better sample of my work and of my competency. And then he says, well, did you commit any negligence or gross negligence? And he answers no. And that is the sole sum total of any evidence regarding the competency of those appraisals. If you go to the appraisals, you actually find that in the one appraisal where he had hidden the true reason for his capitalization rate, that the out-of-date data, which was one of the problems in that appraisal too, was the out-of-date data in that appraisal report, that he had in a later appraisal, a year later, the exact same schedule of out-of-date data coming to a different capitalization rate than the original one, with no explanation as to why in the first appraisal it justified a 9% capitalization rate, but in the second appraisal it justified an 11% capitalization
rate. Am I correct, though, his argument is that these are all points you could have raised, but you didn't raise before the commission?
The error really was, I think, that we lost on the case, not that we could have raised them, was that we did not object to the pro se litigant entering in whatever testimony and documents he wanted to enter into.
I mean, did you put on evidence about this, the three later appraisals?
We did
and
not.
Why they thought
we
they,
did not. He did not. He had not
if
provided.
You look at them on their face, they have problems, is what you're
yeah.
saying.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just saying that when you do go back and look at them on their face, they don't show it. Commissioner Chappell tried to claim that they somehow were different when we looked at them on their face, but they aren't. They have mathematical errors. They have these same kind of errors. They have the same kind of unit of comparison errors. They're identical. I mean, they really did not. His standard of the way he did his appraisals did not change one bit as he went on to that next level. Now, the commission then rules on an improper standard. It doesn't find on whether or not the appraiser's commission was justified in its position in the underlying case, but whether or not whether the commission had a proper basis for appealing. That just is the wrong standard. It's not supported by it's not supported by the prior cases. The prior case in Greenbrier basically says, specifically provides, determination on the issue of substantial justification shall be based on the record made in the agency proceeding for which fees are requested, not on the determination of the higher court when reviewing the agency action for error.
And the agency proceeding for which fees are requested, does that include the AHC proceeding?
Well, the agency proceeding is really a defined term, and it refers to it means the underlying action.
But if he had an attorney, he'd be seeking fees for later too. That's why it's a little confusing the way it says agency proceeding.
The cases have ruled that even though when they prevail at that first hearing and then it gets appealed, they get to use all the attorney fees. They don't get capped at just the attorneys for that case. They get all of them. So it's very normal. That's not an unusual part of this case, that he gets to do all the attorney's fees, I believe, even through to this hearing today, if he is to ultimately prevail on this issue.
And only the original appraisal was before the agency, you're saying, and so we can only consider that deciding whether there was substantial justification? Did the original agency have the three later appraisals before it also?
The agency had all the appraisals in front of it. It had the 2006 and the 2007.
Thank you.
Administrative Hearing Commission's decision was ultimately that they found the 2007
more
recent,
therefore more
relevant.
I just wanted to know what was before the agency. Thank you.
Yeah, they had them all.
I think your time is up. We'll hear. You are
a little bit more
from you.
Mainly, I would just probably note to Garland. The Garland case was most recently decided, and it says the state agency asserted an erroneous position in the agency proceeding. I would also just note that in the special factors, there was no factual basis for much underneath there.
Your time is up. Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Those are adding up, not going down. I'm sorry.
That's fine.
I thought
many
you said
people
yes.
do that. That's all
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
They are going, yes.
I've looked and saw a number of instances.
That's all right.
May it please the court, Mr. Funk would like to thank you for accepting a transfer of this case. He's been at this for 9 years with the Missouri Real Estate Appraisers Commission over his license and over these attorney fees, and he does appreciate the opportunity to have a full consideration of the matter. He ended with Mr. Jacobs talking primarily about whether MERAC was substantially justified, so I'll talk about that first. Was MERAC substantially justified in its decisions that it made in order to support an award of attorney fees? The way this went, Mr. Funk completed all the requirements for his general appraiser license. He submitted his application, and that was in January of 2007. He received a letter from MERAC saying, send us two appraisals. He had submitted a log of appraisals, and they wanted these two particular appraisals, and he looked at them and he said, these are residential appraisals, these are not commercial appraisals. He had done commercial appraisals because part of the requirement is you do commercial appraisals under the supervision of a commercial appraiser, and that's you have to do that in order to get your commercial appraiser license. So he called the MERAC and they said, no, send these are the ones we want. So he bundled up his residential appraisals and sent them down to MERAC. In March, MERAC was going to have a meeting, and they were going to decide on his application. And the day before the meeting, they called him and said, we asked for the wrong appraisals. We need these two commercial appraisals. Well, he had to scramble around. It's not as easy as I thought it was, but it's not as easy as just photocopying off something and sending it. He had to put it together and get it down to them so they could consider it. And the appraisals they asked for, the South McGuire Street appraisal, the one Mr. Jacobs was talking about with the capitalization issue, was the first commercial appraisal he had ever done. And the other one they asked for was a property in Windsor, Missouri, a two-story business building on Main Street. So they considered those. They called him and asked him to come to their meeting in May to discuss the appraisal reports. He went. There's a transcript of that. I was able to read it. They asked a couple of questions about the appraisal reports, and then basically it was just an oral examination about appraisal techniques. Some of them rather esoteric appraisal techniques that I've personally never seen in an appraisal. It took them then 14 weeks before they informed him that he was turned down. And we found out at the fee hearing before the Administrative Hearing Commission, they had decided in May to turn him down. And when I asked, well, why did it take 14 weeks to get a letter turning you down, the lady said, it took us that long to type it up. So he appeals without an attorney, went before the Administrative Hearing Commission, won on his own. Prior to that hearing, he submitted three different appraisal reports. These are some that he had done after he had more training, more experience, and he thought they were better representations of his work. And despite the representations of Mr. Jacob, I disagree with him. They are much better than the first appraisal that he did. They had those appraisal reports for 6 months before the administrative hearing. They called an expert witness at the administrative hearing. His name is James Summers. Mr. Funk asked him, well, what about my later appraisal reports? And he had never seen them. They never asked him to even consider them. And one of the things MERAC is supposed to do is turn down people who are not qualified. Another thing they're supposed to do is give licenses to people who are qualified.
Well, he said that they asked your client to provide a bunch of additional information and his working papers, and he failed to do so. So they didn't feel it was appropriate to consider them. Is that something within their discretion to decide what's appropriate to look at, deciding if someone's qualified?
I suppose, but they didn't even object to them at the administrative hearing. They came into evidence just the way they were, just the way.
And do we look at what the opposing counsel says the real meat of this disagreement on this issue between you two is? Where we look at what if their action was substantially justified, do we look at in making that initial decision about whether he should get a license, or do we look at whether they were justified in appealing the AHC decision, or what do the cases say to us about that?
Well, the cases talk about the initial decision, but the cases also say you're entitled to attorney fees on appeal. Mm-hmm. And he didn't have an attorney until the appeal was filed, until the first petition for review was filed. And so it's our position, we've never agreed that MERAC was substantially justified in turning them down in the first place. And that was hotly contested in the first appeal. We both wrote a lot of words about that in our briefs. But we think the decision to appeal the Administrative Hearing Commission was also not substantially justified.
And is there a case that says we look at that?
We're entitled to attorney fees on appeal.
And I understand that. That's all I can say about it. Well, but if you could answer that question, whether or not there's any cases, and you're certainly entitled, if you prevail on appeal, to get attorney's fees on appeal, but is the issue on appeal for attorney's fees whether what the agency did initially was substantially justified, or is it whether they were justified in appealing?
I don't know of any case which says that the question is whether they were substantially justified in appealing. I don't have any.
So you're suggesting we should hold that here, that this is a first impression issue?
I think
issue.
You should, yes. Okay. I think they made several mistakes along the way in the way they treated the citizen of the state in the consideration of his application. So, another claim of MERAC is the only evidence at the administrative hearing was Mr. Funk's testimony, that, these appraisal reports were done in substantial compliance with USPAP. And that he learned and he does better and his competency was very good. Well, the standard of review at the Court of Appeals is whether there's competent and substantial evidence to support the award. Is this a rare case where the award is contrary to the overwhelming weight of the evidence? The trial judge determines the facts, determines credibility, and the weight to be given to the evidence. There was a lot, first of all, his opinions were admissible. There's case law to support that. Secondly, those opinions came in without objection. The judge was entitled to consider them, entitled to give them whatever weight he wanted to give them. Thirdly, there was lots of other evidence to support the award. Mr. Funk admitted these three appraisal reports into evidence without objection. They supported the award. The commissioner relied on them. He testified he was very competent. His reporting had improved. He had years of experience as a real estate appraiser by the time of the first administrative hearing. He was thus familiar with USPAP, the Uniform Standards on Professional Appraisal Practices, which, by the way, in those days was a bog. They've improved it some. He'd had over 3,000 hours of appraisal work. He had all of his educational requirements necessary for his general commercial license, 180 hours of classroom work. He had done over 1,500 hours of general commercial work under the supervision of a certified appraiser, and he had passed the test. There was no way MERAC was going to win that appeal, yet they appealed it anyway. We think that they were not substantially justified in appealing that case, and we think we are asking you to hold that this entitles Mr. Funk to attorney fees.
You have challenged that he had to file the request for his attorney's fees in the place where he first prevailed. Is that right?
Judge, when we won before the Western District.
Within the time period.
The time period.
When he first prevailed. But so you're challenging that he didn't have to file it in that time.
He couldn't. He didn't.
Because that, you're arguing he's also prevailed on appeal. But then you filed the request for attorney's fees below rather than with the Court of Appeals. So tell us why that shouldn't preclude him from getting attorney's fees.
When the Court of Appeals handed down its mandate, it lost jurisdiction. And I knew that, so I said, well, they have no jurisdiction. The statute says you file in the administrative body before which you prevail. That's 536.087.4. So I chose to file it there.
Point three say you submit to the court, agency, or commission that rendered the final disposition or judgment and application, which shows the party the prevailing party and asking for fees?
Yes, and the cases that say when you win at the administrative hearing level, that's a final decision, even if it's appealed.
Did you really have a timing problem in this case? Was there really a timing issue? I mean, there has been some timing issues in other cases, but what was your timing problem here?
I filed it within 30 days of when we were finished in the Court of Appeals, if that counts. But there's never been a case like this because there's never been a case where the individual wins before the Administrative Hearing Commission without an attorney. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't file it in the Court of Appeals. They'd lost jurisdiction. I filed it where he first prevailed. And then when the state started complaining about that, I asked the Western District to withdraw its mandate and consider the attorney fee application, and the Western District refused to do that. So we were stuck before the Administrative Hearing Commission.
Well, in essence, though, the provision of attorney's fees is remedial in nature, because the legislature decided that if you prevail, you should get attorney's fees,
yes,
which,
sir,
is generally on. And I'm not sure we should be playing a game of whack-a-mole. Well, which court do you go to? You hit this one, you hit that one. You're just trying to get your attorney's fees.
Yes, sir. And I think it is a remedial statute, but that conflicts with the fact that it's a waiver of sovereign immunity and the statute should be strictly construed. Our position is this. The statute says you file this the administrative body before the party has prevailed, and you file it when the decision's final. The Administrative Hearing Commissioner's decision was a final decision, but it sure wasn't final for Mark Funk. He had to go to the Cole County Circuit Court, and he had to go to the Western District Court of Appeals. The administrative decision was in November of 2008, and the Western District's mandate came down in February of 2010. So the reality of the situation is that the Administrative Hearing Commissioner's decision was not final for Mr. Funk. Mr. Funk didn't think it was final, having to go through all this other process in order to be able to get his license. I think that you could stay with the decisions that say if you prevail before the Administrative Hearing Commission, you've got an attorney, you file within 30 days, that's okay. But I think you could also interpret final to mean final, and that's when the case is over. And we did that. We filed within 30 days after the matter was final. There were no more reviews. Another issue briefed, if we get past the filing issue and the timeliness of the filing, another issue is the statute says, that's 536.087, that reasonable fees based upon prevailing market rates may be awarded, but no fees in excess of $75 an hour can be awarded unless the court finds there are special factors to justify a higher fee. The statute went into effect in 1989. It was 27 years ago. $75 an hour might have been a reasonable fee based upon prevailing market rates in 1989, but it's not now. I can't pay my overhead at $75 an hour, and I don't think we have an ostentatious practice with an ostentatious overhead.
Well, there have been cases about special factors. Indeed, in the federal system, they had started the same time at $75, but in the federal system, they took into consideration on equal access to justice cases that there would be inflation. And, right. And if you applied the federal standard with the same $75 start, the fees are supposed to be commercially reasonable.
Correct. And they do look at the cost of living, increases in the cost of living.
Okay. And those are all easily discernible from the economic reports.
Sure.
But our statute doesn't let us do that, but you noted that at least one of the Court of Appeals has said you look at the unavailability of counsel at the statutory rate in determining whether that's a special factor.
There's a difference between the way the Eastern District handles this and the way the Western District handles it. In the Eastern District, they've held the limited availability of qualified attorneys in the area who are willing to take a case at $75 an hour is a special factor that can justify an increased fee. The Western District has handled it differently. It has not followed the Eastern District decisions. It has specifically talked about them and stated it will not follow them, and has held that evidence that the prevailing hourly rate for competent attorneys is higher than $75 an hour is insufficient to support the finding of a special factor as a matter of law.
Of course, prevailing rate is a different question whether you can find a competent attorney at the statutory rate, isn't it?
Yes.
Maybe you could find someone someplace in between.
I don't think you're going to find an attorney in practice today trying to make a living who's going to do it for $75 an hour today. You can't afford to do it. Mm-hmm. So then the purpose of the statute is defeated, because people are not going to be awarded their fees if the state has done something to them that was not substantially justified. And to further confuse things, there was an Eastern District case, and I'm out of time. Thank you all.
Thank you.
I'd like to clarify maybe one factual thing I may have misanswered or may have confused. The 2007 appraisals were not available when the Real Estate Appraisers Commission was first reviewing the application. They came into play during the litigation. And so those were always...
Before the AHC.
Before the AHC. Those were always part of the defense. Second, it is as easy as photocopying and sending in the appraisal and the work file. Appraisers have an obligation to maintain a work file at all times, to be in place. They should just be able to copy it. It's not really significant, though, because at no time during the litigation did Mr. Funk come in and say, you know, I made a mistake. What I gave you wasn't really the right appraisal. This is the right appraisal. He never changed anything in what he provided. They didn't look at it the next day anyway because of the delay, which was caused by a new staff that didn't realize it asked for residential appraisals instead of commercial appraisals. It got pushed off. But it didn't end up playing any real role in the litigation. Second, Greenbrier involved exactly what they're claiming to be excused from in the Court of Appeals. Greenbrier involved a case where the Supreme Court had issued their mandate and at first blush thought they were therefore out of jurisdiction, denied it not because of the mandate issue but because they thought it properly belonged in the Administrative Hearing Commission. When Greenbrier came back, they then withdrew their mandate to decide that they could look at the case when they had it on appeal. and exercise their authorities on the first filing, which had been done at an earlier time.
Are you saying that after the mandate issues, the appellate court, Greenbrier held the appellate court has jurisdiction to consider?
Basically, yes, because that's exactly what the Supreme Court did. They could have withdrawn their mandate to then consider the case. The real appeal time does not run at all in relation to the mandate. I think that was maybe in confusion at the time of Greenbrier. Greenbrier clarified it that it has to be filed within 30 days after the 15 days allowed for post opinion orders, and then they have that 30 days. The mandate came before that 30 days had run in Greenbrier. Greenbrier then withdrew the mandate and allowed them to do it. The Court of Appeals could have withdrawn its mandate, but they still would have had it in a severely late filing at that point in front of their court, and they also
Because normally, I mean, withdrawing a mandate is a very, very unusual and extraordinary thing, and if a court files a mandate and that cuts off a party's right to their statutorily authorized recovery, that seems to be a...
And that was brought up in Greenbrier, that just seemed like we've got a system here that doesn't work. So they withdrew the mandate to allow for the attorney's fee statute to have its place.
You're basically saying the statute's written in a way that doesn't coordinate with the way this court's rules work.
It doesn't coordinate with your mandate rules.
Right.
I don't think there's a set day when you issue your mandate. I think that can come out at any time. Your administrative procedures allow for it to go out after the 15 days runs. So yeah, they don't. And Greenbrier says that and allowed for the withdrawal of the mandate. Also, in the federal standards on special factors. Well, I'm out of time, but I thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.